Okay, we're back in Exodus chapter number 7. And last week we followed Moses as he's still grappling with the idea of obeying God and going back to Pharaoh, because the first time didn't work out so well for him. And whenever he came back, even the children of Israel didn't want to listen to him. And he thought, if Israel won't listen to me, why would Pharaoh listen to me? And so his commission is renewed. He showed Pharaoh the signs. He's cast down the serpent. And the magicians of the Egyptians did likewise. And Pharaoh's heart was still hardened. He refused to let the people of Israel go. And we talked a little bit about the miracles, the signs. We talked a little bit about the fact that the magicians were able to reproduce that first sign. And we're going to see the first three plagues they're actually able to reproduce. They're able to, actually the first two, if I remember properly. They're able to turn water into blood, and they're able to bring frogs out of the water. And we'll see that today. But anyway, we see that there is a spiritual power out there that Satan can work lying wonders. He can produce knockoffs, cheap counterfeits, things that are similar but inferior to what God does. And he still does that to this day. He tries to make cheap knockoffs of the miracles of God. He tries to put forth things that are similar to the signs that we find in the Bible, but not really. And he uses those things to mislead and to harden people today. Because as people see these things, they either follow after the false religions that that utilize them, or it causes people to harden themselves to God because they see it as just being a bunch of trickery, just basically a spectacle, a circus sideshow. And so one way or the other, it hardens people toward the gospel. Sometimes it seems like Satan is very good at getting people to follow with these signs and miracles just to have whoever they're following to fall flat on their face, to sin majorly, to something happen to completely delegitimize everything. And we find that within the Catholic Church. There's one example that they are purported as being followers of God, as being a Christian organization, but yet you see all the corruption that takes place within it. And so Satan can raise up a religion that seems to be Christian in origin and then use it to bring all kinds of atrocities into this world. You search through history, you find their campaigns, their crusades that they went on, the way that they have murdered and mistreated people down through the ages, and you find that Satan has been in charge of that, that he has used something in the name of God with false power and authority in order to get people to not trust God, get people to question God. And still to this day, you try to talk to people who are skeptical or cynical about Christianity. What do they point to? They point to all of the wars, all of the atrocities, all of the tortures and the murder and the bloodshed that has taken place in the name of Christ. And so this is what Satan's game has been all along, and this is what was going on back here. That if Moses can come, throw down a staff, make it into a serpent, and Pharaoh's magicians can do likewise, they see no difference. And so it doesn't matter who they follow, and they're going to follow the false one. Mm-hmm. And so anyway, we saw with the miracle of the staff last week that the serpent in Egypt was revered as being a sign of authority. Even the pharaohs would have the serpent on their headdresses between their eyes. Several of the gods that they worshipped had that as part of their godly garb, I guess. We find that even a lot of the pharaohs would carry that staff in the shape of a serpent as a sign of authority. Whenever Moses threw down his serpent or his staff, or Aaron threw down his staff, and it became a serpent, it was a sign to them of God's authority. And whenever they were able to throw down their their staffs, and they became serpents as well. They were lesser authorities. And God, the God of Moses, the one that was empowering him, swallowed up all of their authority. And so we saw that last week. And so this week things begin getting a little bit more interesting as, I guess in a way, I hate to use this term, but God kind of ups his game. Okay? If it wasn't a game, this was something that he was doing to bring about the salvation of Israel, to bring about the knowledge of God throughout his people and throughout the Israel, or excuse me, throughout Egypt and throughout the nation surrounding Egypt, that his name would be known in all of the world. And it did have that effect. And so as he kind of ups the bar here, raises the bar, we find that in verses 14 through the end of the chapter, that Pharaoh was not going to let them go. And so God is now going to give them more than a serpent. And let's go ahead and read verses 14 through the end of the chapter, as long as I don't get too tongue-tied as I read it. It says, "And the Lord said unto Moses, Pharaoh's heart is hardened. He refuseth to let the people go. Get thee unto Pharaoh in the morning. Lo, he goeth out into the water. And thou shalt stand by the river's brink against he come. And the rod which was turned to a serpent shalt thou take in thine hand. And thou shalt say unto him, The Lord God of the Hebrews has sent me unto thee, saying, Let my people go, that they may serve me in the wilderness. And behold, hitherto thou wouldest not hear. Thus saith the Lord, In this thou shalt know that I am the Lord." There we find a key verse. We find God's purpose, his reasoning behind this. "In this thou shalt know that I am the Lord." Because Pharaoh's already said, "I don't know the Lord, neither will I obey him." So, "In this thou shalt know that I am the Lord. Behold, I will smite with the rod that is in mine hand upon the waters which are in the river, and they shall be turned to blood. And the fish that is in the river shall die, and the river shall stink, and the Egyptians shall loathe to drink of the water of the river. And the Lord spake unto Moses, say unto Aaron, Take thy rod and stretch out thine hand upon the waters of Egypt, upon their streams, upon their rivers, and upon their ponds, and upon their pools of water, that they may become blood, and that there may be blood throughout all the land of Egypt, both in vessels of wood and in vessels of stone. And Moses and Aaron did so as the Lord commanded, and he lifted up the rod and smote the waters that were in the river in the sight of Pharaoh and in the sight of the servants, and all the waters that were in the river were turned to blood. And the fish that was in the river died, and the river stank, and the Egyptians could not drink of the water of the river. And there was blood throughout all of the land of Egypt, and the magicians of Egypt did so with their enchantments. And Pharaoh's heart was hardened, neither did he hearken unto them, as he said, or excuse me, as the Lord had said. And Pharaoh turned and went into his house, neither did he set his heart to this also. And the Egyptians digged round about the river for water to drink, for they could not drink of the water of the river. And 7 days were fulfilled after that the Lord had smitten the river." And so, as we see here, God tells Moses, Pharaoh is going to be coming down to the river tomorrow morning. Whenever he's coming, I want you to meet him along the way and tell him, because you will not let my people go, I'm going to turn this river into blood. And so as I turn this river into blood, the fish are going to die, the river is going to stink, and you're not going to have the water that you need to drink. And of course, Pharaoh doesn't listen. He doesn't believe it. And so God tells him, go ahead. And so Aaron raises up his rod. He smites the water of the river. The rivers all turn into blood. It'd be kind of disgusting, wouldn't it? The waters all turn into blood. And as Moses had said, the fish died. The whole land stank. The people loathed to drink of the water. It says that they dug about the water alongside the river banks, trying to find clean water because they could not drink the water of the rivers. And so whenever all of this happened, rather than making things better, Pharaoh's magicians came out. Now, this is just kind of hard for me to swallow, no pun intended. Whenever all of the waters became blood, all of the waters associated with the Nile River, okay? It says the streams, the ponds, even the water that was being contained within vessels of stone and all of these things. All of it became blood. They dug about the river. They found a little bit of fresh water. And then they brought that little bit of fresh water to Pharaoh's magicians, and they turned it into blood too. Well, I guess they probably just had it in like a container. There wasn't any fish with it.
You know what I mean? That sort of boggled my mind a bit. How it says that they could replicate it, even what they did likewise. So there must have been, was it ponds there that had fish in it still, which they, you know what I mean?
Well, I don't know that it says anything as far as them and the fish. Is there a verse that says anything about the that I missed?
No, it just says that they did likewise.
They did likewise?
So I don't know if that
is supposed. But it seems to me that it was all of the waters that was associated with the Nile that became infected in this way. And so there had to be some freshwater sources not tied into the Nile. Maybe they had to trek a good journey away from the Nile. Maybe it was that they were able to dig wells down below the surface, below the levels of the Nile or whatnot. But in whatever way, the magicians there were able to repeat the act of turning water into blood. But what boggles my mind is, why is it that they're seeking to turn what little bit of fresh water they do have into blood? They are actually making things worse instead of making it better. They are heaping more judgment upon themselves. It's like not only is God judging them, they are actually increasing it themselves. They're making things worse for themselves. And so anyway, whenever they are able to replicate this, it says that Pharaoh's heart in once again. And so Pharaoh says, no, I'm not letting them go, even if water is turned into blood. And if they really had power, if these magicians really had power, if they were as great as Pharaoh was letting on, they should have been able to turn some of the blood into fresh water again, right? Bring out some sort of purification methods or do something. But they weren't able to undo what God did. They were only able to increase the suffering. And that's what Satan always tries to do, is increase the suffering. He's not happy when we're happy and healthy. He wants to make us suffer. And so anyway, there are some today that try to explain this away. You'll probably watch documentaries, National Geographic or Learning Channel, Discovery, something like that, that try to say that it could have been some sort of algae or bacteria. There's bacterial growth that in different places will turn the water into a red-looking color and things like that. And they say, well, this is probably what happened. But that doesn't line up with the Bible. That's trying to explain away God's miracles, which men are adept at doing, right? And so some of them say that maybe it was red silt or mud from the desert came in and turn the water into this bloody look. But the Bible calls it blood. It appears to have the properties and the effects of blood. And it appeared immediately at Moses' command and did exactly what Moses said that it would do. And Moses wouldn't have any way of bringing about those things. It would be just as much as of a miracle, would it not, for him to make a spontaneous algae growth like that to turn it all red and kill the fish. It would be just as big of a miracle, wouldn't it? But it isn't what the Bible says. It says that it was blood. There are those today who try to explain away the crossing of the Red Sea on dry ground. And they say, well, it wasn't really the Red Sea. It's a typo in our Bible, and it's really supposed to be the Reed Sea. And the Reed Sea is only like ankle deep. And so it's able to maybe a wind come through and push the waters back a little bit and dry the ground out. And they said, this is how they crossed on dry ground. But wait a minute. How did Pharaoh's army drown in ankle deep water? They try to explain away God's miracles, and they just, there isn't an explanation that keeps it from being a miracle, is it? And so anyway, we've got to be careful trying to explain away the things of God, try to reason them away, because that's what people try to do, and it's not going to work. So like I said, it happened at Moses' command. It wasn't a natural phenomenon, and it seems to me that Moses, Pharaoh, and all of the Egyptians agree that it was blood. And so they should have known, right? Had all the properties of blood. It wasn't just the color of blood. They said it was blood. It didn't say that the waters became red like crimson. It said it became blood. And so for significance on this, the Egyptians worshiped the Nile River. Okay, we have a little bit of a knowledge of geography. We know that Egypt is not necessarily a green and fertile land, only the area around the Nile and around the Nile Delta. You get much away from that, it's desert land, it's wasteland, there's nothing there, it's uninhabitable. And so the people of Egypt living around the Nile and around the Nile Delta depended upon it. Once a year, it would flood and flood all of the area around it, and it would bring all of the rich soil, all of the fertile soil that had been run off everywhere else, and it would deposit that on the banks of the river, and all the Egyptians would then do all their farming in that fertile land that was brought up as a result of the flood. So they depended on that yearly flooding to come and to deposit that silt to make it capable of growing all of the food that they needed there in the desert and in the Nile region. And so they seen the Nile as being the lifeblood of all of Egypt. And they deified the Nile. They said that one of their main gods, Osiris, was the god of the Nile, and that he was able to, let me see if I get my thoughts right on this one. They considered this to be his blood in the Nile, okay? And they personified the yearly flooding in their god Happy, H-A-P-I, and they had him pictured as this man. You see statues of him, a man with breasts like a woman, and he was bringing life and giving life to all the people of Egypt through the blood of Osiris, their god, in the land of the Nile, in the land of Egypt. And so they actually did worship this as being the blood of gods. And so what did God do? He made it into literal blood. And rather than bringing life, it brought death. And it's very possible that as Pharaoh was coming down to this river, he may have been coming to one of their celebrations in worship of the river. It may have been during the time of the flood, whenever they were coming down to worship and praise the river that is the lifeblood of Egypt. And Moses stood before him and he said, if you won't let God's people go, he's going to take your God that you think is the lifeblood of Egypt, and he is going to make it literal blood, and he's going to bring death on Egypt. And it happened before his eyes. And what was Pharaoh's response to this? It says in verse 23, and Pharaoh turned and went into his house, neither did he set his heart to this also. This gives us a good glimpse into Pharaoh and who he is. He sees the entire land turned to suffering. He sees the river turned into blood. He sees the hopes of their crops, all of the fish that they would be depending upon, dying, laying on the banks of the river in that blood. And he goes home, closes himself behind closed doors there, and he ignores the hardship of his people. He spends a week there. He can send his people out, his servants out, to go and dig and bring water to him, locks himself in the house and ignores it. And I think we can find a parallel to that in the way that people respond to God still to this day. God can still bring things into our lives that should get our attention, and somehow we ignore them. Somehow we just barricade ourselves away, we lock ourselves away, and we ignore the things that God is bringing into our lives to get our attention. This is what Pharaoh did. And so anyway, another thing that we find in this is that with their worship of the river, that they were worshiping God's blessings rather than the God who gave them the blessings. And we're just as guilty, I think, of doing that today. God has blessed us greatly. He has given us very much. And yet we still tend to elevate the creation above the Creator. We worship the creature more than the Creator, right? And so this is what they were doing here as well. They were worshiping all of God's creation. And we're going to find all throughout these 10 plagues that each one of them combats something that the Egyptians were worshiping. And really, it was something that God had created that they had began to worship. And so they worshiped creation rather than the Creator. The one who, or I guess the gifts, were worshipped rather than the giver. And so that brings us to chapter number 8. And we come with the second miracle, the second plague. Kind of weird thing you have a plague being a miracle, but it is, because it is something supernatural, something that isn't normal. And so let's look in chapter 8, verse 1. It says, "And the Lord spake unto Moses, Go unto Pharaoh, and say unto him, Thus saith the Lord, Let my people go, that they may serve me. And if thou refuse to let them go, behold, I will smite all thy borders with frogs. And the river shall bring forth frogs abundantly, which shall go up and come into thine house, and into thy bedchamber, and upon thy bed, and into the house of thy servants, and upon thy people, and into thine ovens, and into thine kneading troughs. And the frog shall come up both on thee and upon thy people and upon all thy servants." Now pause for just a second there. Notice in verse 4 it says, "They will come up on you." You can't lock yourself in your house in your bedroom and escape them. And so anyway, "And the Lord spake unto Moses, Say unto Aaron, Stretch forth thine hand with thy rod over the streams and over the rivers and over the ponds, and cause the frogs to come upon the land of Egypt. And Aaron stretched out his hand over the waters of Egypt, and the frogs came up and covered the land of Egypt, and the magicians did so with their enchantments, and brought up frogs upon the land of Egypt. And Pharaoh called for Moses and said, or and Aaron, and said, Entreat the Lord that he may take away the frogs from me and from my people, and I will let the people go, that they may do sacrifice unto the Lord. And Moses said unto Pharaoh, Glory over me, when shall I entreat for thee, and for thy servants, and for thy people, to destroy the frogs from thee and thy houses, that they may remain in the river only? And he said, Tomorrow. And he said, Be it according to thy word, that thou mayest know," there's that phrase again, "that thou mayest know that there is none like unto the Lord our God. And the frog shall depart from thee and from thy houses and from thy servants and from thy people, and they shall remain in the river only. And Moses and Aaron went out from Pharaoh, and Moses cried unto the Lord because of the frogs which he had brought up against Pharaoh. And the Lord did according to the word of Moses, and the frogs died out of the houses, out of the villages, and out of the fields, and they gathered them together upon heaps, and the land stank. But when Pharaoh saw that there was respite, he hardened his heart and hearkened not unto them as the Lord had said." So here we have plague number two. And God again sends Moses to Pharaoh with his statement, "Let my people go or else." Okay? God is teaching Pharaoh who God is. And so this time God is going to send frogs. And at first glance, we look at it, we're like, really, God, frogs? Of all things, you know, we've seen frogs before. You think of a plague, you don't think of frogs. Right? But even though it seems silly, look at the extent of it. It says that it was in their bedrooms, it was in their beds, it was in their kitchens, it was in their ovens, it was in their kneading troughs, it was everywhere. It was in their houses, it was in their fields, it was in their lanes, it was on the footpath. It was everywhere you went, there were smushy, slimy frogs. Not only the sight, the feel, the smell, but also the sound. Frogs are annoying. Y'all ever been around somewhere where there's a lot of frogs? There's not very many frogs in Ireland, okay? But back where we were from, every spring you had frogs that were called the spring peepers. And we enjoyed listening to them, okay? But they would come out and they would just make the awfulest noise. But it was like, you know, spring was there. And then you'd have the big bullfrogs. And it was kind of that submarine. It was nice to listen to. That would get annoying fast. It was fun at first, you know, lay there and listen to it for a little while, but you wouldn't want to be surrounded by it. It's nice whenever there's like a pond or a swamp a kilometer away and you hear it, not whenever they are in your bedroom. You ever have a cricket turn loose in your bedroom? Just that cricket, you can't catch him, and all night he's just making noises. Frog would be similar to that, right?
The French would love them, though.
The French would? Well, that'd be more of them than they can eat. Oh, you remember whenever the Jews were in the wilderness and they complained about the manna, and so God sent quails, and he said, "You're going to have so much, it'll be coming out your nostrils." Yeah. Well, this would be the equivalent for the French. And so anyway, every moment they were going to be surrounded by frogs. And to make matters even worse, guess what? The Egyptians worshiped frogs. They were surrounded by gods. But anyway, they worshipped a god or a goddess by the name of Hekt, H-E-K-T or H-E-K-E-T, depending on how you what spelling you find. And it was a goddess with a woman's body and a frog's head. It's not hard to find pictures. Google it. It's pretty weird-looking stuff. There's plenty of images of it on pyramids and places in Egypt that they found. And so anyway, she had the head of a frog. She was the goddess of birth and of fertility. And so with that, the frogs were considered sacred. They weren't to be killed. They weren't to be harmed. So now imagine your trip to town or to the neighbor's house or even to your bathroom whenever you have little frogs everywhere that are sacred and you can't step on them because they are linked to this goddess and to all of their religion that they follow. And it wouldn't be too long before they begin to resent instead of revere these frogs. And so we find that the magicians could do likewise. They could bring frogs out of the river. Notice the frogs didn't just materialize upon command. It was that they came out of the river. This river that, however long before, we don't know the exact extent of time, but this river that had been blood before now was bringing forth hordes of frogs hopping everywhere around them. And so now the magicians go down to the river's brink. They take their staff, do whatever, and frogs start hopping up out of the river and said, "Hey, see, we can do the same thing." But once again, rather than getting rid of frogs, they brought more frogs. They made the problem worse. And honestly, I think if I was the Egyptians, I'd be mad at these guys. Be like, "Do you not think we have enough frogs? Did you not think we had enough blood? Do you not think things were bad enough? Why are you bringing more?" But we have a tendency, whenever we get in a bad situation, to make it worse, don't we? About the saying, digging your hole deeper.
Funny thing is that he never went back to the magicians to get rid of the frogs.
No, he never did.
Like Moses.
Mm-hmm. And that's a very good point because he didn't. There's nowhere that we find that he actually requested of the magicians. I'd say he probably did. And they probably said, "We can't do it." I don't know. But he did at this point finally come back to Moses and he said, "Okay, I give in. This frog thing is getting way out of hand. I can't go anywhere. I could escape the blood. I could have my servants bring me water and all this. But everywhere I go, there is a frog." Imagine going around your house, you open up the cupboard, there's a frog staring at you. You close that, you open up the microwave, there's a frog. You go to put your shoe on, oh, there's a frog. You open up your sock drawer, there's a frog. You go get in the shower, one jumps on your face. Frogs everywhere. That would drive you bonkers, wouldn't it? Yeah, that would be something. You go, you open up the toilet, and there's one swimming around. And so anyway, although the magicians can mimic the plague, Pharaoh is seeking relief now. And so he did what many other people do. He begins to bargain with God. He says, "God, if you will do this, then I will do that. If you will get rid of the frogs, then I will let your people go." And so whenever the trial passed, so did his willingness to obey God. As long as he was in the thick of it, as long as things were really bad, he would make all the promises in the world. And as soon as relief came, he forgot about it. Have you ever done that? "God, if you just get me out of this situation, if you just come through this one time, then I'll do this or I'll do that." And we'll promise him the moon, right? Well, I know lost people do it all the time. They're seeking him in their time of trouble, and as soon as the trouble passes, forget God again, right? And so we need to be careful of the promises that we make in trials and make sure that we stick to those promises, that we keep them whenever the times are good again. And so whenever we look at this here, we find that Moses actually gives Pharaoh the option. He says, "You get to pick when the frogs leave." Now, to me, that's a no-brainer. See, Moses comes to him and he says, "Glory over me, when shall I entreat for thee?" So he actually gives Pharaoh a little bit of respect, a little bit of honor in this time, okay? And so he says, "I'll let you decide when will the frogs leave. Immediately, right now, get rid of my one going." But what does Pharaoh say? "Tomorrow." Did y'all catch that? "Tomorrow." Why would he wait till tomorrow? I mean, if you're surrounded by frogs, he's coming and he's saying, "I need relief. I need rid of these frogs." "Okay, you tell me when you want rid of them." "Tomorrow." Doesn't make sense to me. I mean, I would say immediately, right now. But Moses is giving him the opportunity to pick the time so that Pharaoh couldn't say that Moses was the one doing it. So it would take away all questions of who was behind it, because Pharaoh was the one that picked the time. It wasn't Moses. It wasn't something that he orchestrated. It wasn't anything that he was behind. It wasn't even a coincidence that maybe it was another god, someone else. It was just happened that it came after Moses said something. But now Pharaoh actually has a hand in it. And he says, do it tomorrow. And Moses says, okay, be it unto you as you requested here. And so he leaves Pharaoh's presence. And he went about, in verse number 12, he cried unto the Lord because of the frogs. Verse 13, the Lord did according to the word of Moses, and the frogs died out of the houses and out of the villages and out of the fields. Now, here is something that interested me whenever I read this. God didn't cause the frogs to return to the river. That would be too easy, wouldn't it? That'd be too nice, too clean, too pleasant for them to just hop back into the river where they came from. Instead, he kills them. Every single frog just croaks. Sorry, I had to do that. Every single frog died. And so, anyway, sorry. Every single frog died right where it was at. And so everywhere they went, there was dead, slimy, stinking, smelling, rotting frog carcasses. So they got all those together. They piled them in piles. And everywhere they went, there were piles of reminders of what God had done. Piles of reminders of God's judgment. Piles of reminders that God had brought the frogs and that God had the power to kill them, to take them away. He had the power of life. He had the power of death. And they were surrounded by that. This should have been an ominous sign to the Egyptians that God has the power at that just to make all these frogs drop dead. Later on, they're going to find on the 10th plague that he also has the power to do the same with the firstborn. It goes from being frogs to being their own children. He is showing them slowly. And by the way, this is a good illustration of the grace of God, because God starts out with things that are irritating, things that are annoying, things that aren't harmful. Okay, we don't find with the water turned to blood, we don't find that it actually killed any of the people. It lasted for 7 days. No one died of thirst that we know of. It's not recorded. It was unpleasant. It was difficult. It was something they didn't want to go through. But when they got through it, okay, everyone's still fine. But they have seen a demonstration of God. Right? We go to the frogs. Once again, unpleasant. Difficult. Annoying. They probably lost a week's sleep. But yet, we don't find any time of death, right? We're going to find the next one is lice. Now, lice, that ups it just a little bit more, because rather than just stepping on it and stuff, they're crawling all over you, they're biting you, they're making you itch, they are bringing about sores and blisters, they carry disease, all these different things. It ups it a little bit, but what I said here is that God is showing mercy, he's showing grace, he is showing his power without actually bringing any real harm, any real hurt to them, until they've had more than ample opportunity to confess him, to turn to him, to realize that he was God. He demonstrates himself before he ever brings real harm or any real judgment to them. And we can also take that for ourselves just a little bit too, that whenever we are living in a way that is sinful, whenever we are living in a way as children of God that does not align with him and his word and his will, he doesn't just come and smite us right there. He doesn't just strike us dead. He doesn't just come and bring great disaster and torment on us. But he begins dealing with us gently at first. He begins getting our attention. He begins sending wake-up calls. Sometimes it's unpleasant, but it's to get us on track. It's to turn our eyes toward him. If we persist in that, things will ratchet up a little bit, because God loves us and he will not allow us to persist in a way that is contrary to him and to his good work in our lives. And so he will bring greater things in, but we see this as a progression. The longer they harden themselves, the longer they harden their necks, the greater extent God brings judgment upon their lives to bring them to himself. Okay? And so that's something for us to remember. And so anyway, we find here that with the frogs, God kills them the day that he says he's going to. They die. They gather all the heaps together. Verse 15 says, when Pharaoh saw that there was respite, he hardened his heart. Once again, it says that Pharaoh hardened his heart. Notice it says several times that Pharaoh hardens his heart, or his heart is hardened, before it ever says that God hardens his heart. Okay? And so Pharaoh hardened his heart once again and hearkened not unto them as the Lord had said. Just the way that God said it would happen, right? We're not surprised by that. God knew what he was talking about. And so, once again, a reminder here that whenever we make all of these promises to God, whenever we are so willing in the times of hardship to drop everything, to make all these changes, to do all these things, and to bargain with God, keep your promises when you come through it, right? Or even better, don't make promises that you're not intending to keep. God's not one to be bargained with. God knew what he was going to do. God knew what Pharaoh's response was going to be. And I believe by this point in time, Moses has figured it out. Remember up until the water turning into blood that Moses is continuing to whine and complain and misunderstand whatever he thinks. God, what are you doing? Surely by now, Pharaoh should be letting us go. Surely by now, this should have changed his heart. This should have melted his hardness. Surely by now, we should be on our way to the promised land. But now, Moses is starting to cop on. He's realizing that Pharaoh is not going to listen. And he's realizing that God is going to continue to up the things that he's bringing against him. He's going to continue to up the plagues. And he has seen the power of God. And he's beginning to trust the power of God. He's starting to trust God's plan. Because after a couple of these plagues, he says, I see where this is going. Before too long, I think he's probably going to be asking, how long will this guy stand out? How long is he going to hold out? How long will he keep up this stupid way that he is going? I think before it's over with, Moses was actually starting to pity Pharaoh. That might be taking a little bit far, I don't know. But can you just imagine Moses and Aaron walking away from Pharaoh and saying, when's this guy going to learn? What's it going to take? How much is God going to have to do before he finally listens? And I believe that was the change in his response, the change in his view toward God. Because rather than saying, God, you've not held your word, you haven't done what you said you would do, he says, God is doing what he said he would do. And so I do still have the expectation that he's going to deliver us. But boy, what's it going to take to get it across to Pharaoh? And so now, in verse 16 through 19, we have another plague, the third judgment. It says, and the Lord said unto Moses, say unto Aaron, stretch out thy rod and smite the dust of the land, that it may become lice throughout all of the land of Egypt. And they did so, for Aaron stretched out his hand with the rod and smote the dust of the earth. And it became lice in man and in beast. All of the dust of the land became lice throughout all the land of Egypt. And the magicians did so with their enchantments to bring forth lice, but they could not. So there was lice upon man and lice upon beast. And the magician said unto Pharaoh, this is the finger of God. And Pharaoh's heart was hardened, and he hearkened not unto them as the Lord had said. So in this plague that is brought against the Egyptians, I find two new things going on here. Okay, did you catch them as I was reading it? Mm-hmm. Two new things. The first one is there was no forewarning. All the times before, Moses came to Pharaoh and said, let my people go or else. This time God says, just go ahead and do it. He's already hardened his heart. Just go ahead and unleash this one. Now, the second thing that was new about it is that the Egyptians, the magicians, could not replicate it. Now, there's several different ideas behind why they couldn't. It has been put out there that possibly it was because they couldn't create life. And people would counter that one and say, well, they made the staff into a serpent, right? Fair enough, maybe so. But another one, I actually just noticed this as I was reading this. It says that in verse 17, almost the end of the verse, all the dust of the land became lice. It'd be kind of hard for them to turn it into lice if there wasn't any dust left. Just a thought. Now, that might be stretching it just a little bit, but it amused me anyway. And so anyway, as Moses lifted up his staff, or had Aaron to lift up his staff, he caused him to smite the dust of the land and to turn the dust into lice. Now, lice would be miserable, okay? The frogs would be bad enough because they would be everywhere on everything. Yes, they may jump on you, but the lice are going to crawl on you, get in your hair, get on your skin. They are going to bite you. You're going to have a long time of itching and misery. Lice can also carry disease. They can cause infection. They can cause skin irritations, rashes, all those kind of different things, right? And so just the fact that the magicians were daft enough to try to make more lice when they're already crawling with lice says a lot about them. But they were unable to do it. They were unable to kill the lice. They were unable to drive them away. They couldn't even get rid of the lice out of one household, out of one room, off of one person. They were powerless to do anything about it. And so the magicians, whenever they see that they have no power whatsoever, they themselves tell Pharaoh that he is dealing with a much more powerful God than any that they'd ever seen. They said, "This is the finger of God." That was the words of the magicians, right? They should be a hostile witness, shouldn't they? They should be the last ones you would think of admitting that this was a God that was beyond them, that was more powerful than them. But anyway, they become fearful and they said, "This is the finger of God." But it says that Pharaoh was still unmoved. It says that his heart was hardened and he hearkened not unto them. He's still not going to let them go. But as I said, Moses has already caught on by this. He's not a bit discouraged at this point in time. And he's just wondering, where is this going to? What's the next one going to be? Because God hasn't laid out a path for him. He hasn't said, "This is going to be my plan. This is how many steps we're going to take. This is what the plagues are going to be." He just keeps bringing one after another. And so Moses goes to God, gets these marching orders, and he says, "Okay, what's the plague of the day? We've had frogs, we've had lice so far, right?" But I think he's also seeing the trend on this one, because this plague of lice would have targeted the god Seb or Set, depending on where you find it. It's spelled different ways, either S-E-B or S-E-T. And it was the Egyptian god of the desert. And so they worshiped the god of the desert, the god of the dust. Well, now the dust has become a lice. The desert has come to bite them. That's what happened. And so now in verses 20 through 32, this is where we're going to finish up today. But it says in verse number 20, "And the Lord said unto Moses, Rise up early in the morning and stand before Pharaoh. Lo, he cometh forth to the water, and say unto him, Thus saith the Lord, Let my people go, that they may serve me. Else, if thou wilt not let my people go, behold, I will send swarms of flies upon thee, and upon thy servants, and upon thy people, and in thy houses, and the houses of the Egyptians shall be full of swarms of flies, and also the ground whereon they are. And I will sever in that day the land of Goshen, in which my people dwell, that no swarms of flies shall be there, to the end that thou mayest know that I am the Lord in the midst of the earth." There's that phrase again. This is his purpose all along, that you may know I am God. Verse 23, "And I will put a division between my people and thy people. Tomorrow shall this sign be. And the Lord did so, and there came a grievous swarm of flies into the house of Pharaoh, and into his servants' houses, and into all the land of Egypt, and the land was corrupted by reason of the swarm of flies. And Pharaoh called for Moses and Aaron, and said, Go ye, sacrifice to your God in the land. And Moses said, It is not meet so to do, for we shall sacrifice the abomination of the Egyptians to the Lord our God. Lo, shall we sacrifice the abomination of the Egyptians before their eyes, and will they not stone us? We will go 3 days' journey into the wilderness and sacrifice to the Lord our God, as he shall command us. And then Pharaoh said, I will let you go that you may sacrifice to the Lord your God in the wilderness. Only ye shall not go very far away. Entreat for me. And Moses said, behold, I go out from here, and I will entreat the Lord that the swarm of flies may depart from Pharaoh and from his servants and from his people tomorrow. But let Pharaoh deal, let not Pharaoh deal deceitfully anymore in letting, in not letting the people go to sacrifice to the Lord. And Moses went out from Pharaoh and entreated the Lord, and the Lord did according to the word of Moses, and he removed the swarms of flies from Pharaoh, from his servants, and from his people. There remained not one. And Pharaoh hardened his heart at this time also, neither would he let the people go. And so we see at the beginning of this, God is sending a warning. Once again, let my people go or else. So we've returned to that way of doing things. But God tells Moses, he says, Pharaoh is going down to the water again. Remember, this is where it started at, right? Pharaoh is going down to the water again. Meet him as he's coming out. And whenever you meet him coming out, tell him this. And you can imagine Pharaoh and his entourage coming. And they see Moses and Aaron standing at the edge of the water. And Pharaoh just shakes his head and says, oh no, not these guys again. Right? And so he comes before Moses and Aaron. And they said, if you don't let the people go, God is going to send swarms of flies all over Egypt. They're going to be in your house. They're going to be in your servant's house. They're going to be everywhere you go in Egypt. Now, there's been several times I've had a fly or a couple flies stuck in the house. Come in the car with you while you're driving down the road, they'll drive you nuts, right? But could you imagine having swarms of flies everywhere covering everything? No matter where you turn, there's flies. And so he says, this is what's going to happen. And Pharaoh's probably like, eh, flies, we can handle flies. We've had flies before. Not like this, they haven't. But he goes a step further. He says here, I'm going to do something new. You might think that this is just a coincidence, that this is just something that just so happened that these other plagues have come about. And it appears that the Jews have suffered through all these as well. But this time, whenever I send the flies, I'm going to sever the land of Goshen. I'm going to take the land that the Jews live in, and there won't be any flies where they're at. And so could you imagine the boundary line being drawn with flies? You're just walking down the road, and as soon as you cross over into the land of Goshen, no flies. You can like see it on the ground, there's flies here, no flies here. And so God says, I'm going to sever the Israelites. I'm going to keep them separate from the Egyptians with this plague. And I'm going to do this that you can see that the God of the Jews, the God of the Hebrews, is the real God. And so anyway, we're going to see that these flies would be, as I've said several times already, very annoying, very disruptive. But we also know that flies carry disease, right? Definitely not sanitary, not clean, not pleasant creatures. And so they're going to be everywhere in their house. Pharaoh won't be able to escape it. And so whenever we see in verse number 23 that he's going to sever the people of Israel away from the people of Egypt, we can note that God can protect his people and he can shield them from judgment. Okay, he is able to do that no matter what's going on. The nation of Ireland could go through huge distress. The European Union could fall and God could still preserve his people. God could still take care of us. You realize that? And so we get wary of some of the things that are going on, the pandemic and different things like that. And this isn't me saying that God's going to keep us from getting sick or he'll keep you from getting the COVID or whatnot. There's been plenty of Christians who's got it. But my point being that whenever God sends a judgment, he is able to shield his people from it. He's able to do that. He's able to put that separation. And he knows who belongs to him and who doesn't. And so anyway, while they had to go through some of the initial plagues, he separated them before the real severe judgments come. The flies are the last one that wasn't extremely severe. And we see in this a pattern that further enforces my belief that Christians will not go through the tribulation. We have had to go through plenty of irritating things. We have had to go through plenty of suffering and hardships, not us personally, but Christians in general have had to go through plenty, but the Great Tribulation is going to be a time of great suffering. It is going to be a time of judgment, not persecution, a time of judgment. And so I believe wholeheartedly that God will deliver his people before he sets his judgment loose upon this earth. And so Christians won't go through the tribulation. God will sever his people from the rest of this world. This plague targeted their god Hatcock, which is the wife of Osiris. We talked about him being the river god, right? And also there's another god that I don't really know how to pronounce the name, okay? You can write it down if you got a pen and paper, and you can try to pronounce it if you want to. But it is U-A-T-C-H-I-T, which was a female goddess that had wings as a fly. They had some weird stuff going on back then. Have you ever looked at some of the gods that they came up with? But anyway, she had the wings of a fly, and so she was kind of the goddess of flies. And flies were seen as, once again, sacred creatures. They brought about good luck, and they were seen as protecting against disease and misfortune. As a matter of fact, they would actually give like metal, like brass, bronze flies to their valiant warriors coming back home. And so it was seen as an honor to have this sacred fly. All right? And so whenever we consider that the fly is supposedly protected against disease or misfortune, it's only right that the following plague is disease. That there was going to be a disease amongst their cattle, amongst their animals, amongst their livestock. That would be the next one. But we're not going to get into it today, but it does seem fitting to me that that's the one that's going to follow. It wasn't a coincidence. And so in verse 25, Pharaoh calls for Moses, and he offers a compromise. He says, you can sacrifice in the land. Remember, Moses has been saying all along, let us go 3 days' journey. Let us leave the land. Let us go outside of Egypt and do our sacrifices. And he says, you can sacrifice, just don't leave the land. But Moses offers a sensible response. He says, our worship is going to be offensive to the Egyptians. If we sacrifice what God requires us to sacrifice in the land, the Egyptians will stone us. Why? Because some of the animals they hold sacred. And also, they abhorred shepherds, they abhorred sheep. They saw sheep as being unclean. They didn't like sheep in Egypt. And so for the Jews to have these sacrifices there, it would be offensive to the Egyptians. But we find that Satan still pulls the same trick today. He still tempts us as Christians to serve God while staying in the land, staying in the world, right? You don't have to separate from the world to be a Christian. You don't have to be any different. You can blend in with the rest of the world. You can do all of the things that the world does. You can live just like anyone else in the world. There's no problem with you doing all of these things and still being a Christian. Is that not what Satan tells us today? Don't worry about what the Bible calls sin. Don't worry about it, us being a separate and a peculiar person. Don't worry about holiness. Don't worry about any of these things. You can worship God in the land. But God instead tells us that we can't serve two masters. We can't have one foot in the world and one foot in the church house. We can't serve God and mammon. We can't serve God in this world. We can't do it because you're going to fall right smack into the world every time whenever we try to do both. And so in verse number 28, since they couldn't stay in the land, Pharaoh says, fine then. You can go ahead and go, but just don't go too far. Right? You see that in verse number 28? Pharaoh said, I will let you go that you may sacrifice to the Lord your God in the wilderness. Only ye shall not go very far away. Don't mind you being a Christian just as long as you don't become a fanatic. Don't go too far with this whole worshiping God thing. Don't go too far with serving him. It's all right that you're a Christian, but don't be a weirdo about it, right? Is that not what the world says today? Don't go too far. And there is a, I hate to call it a movement, but there's this huge trend, I guess, of not going too far as a Christian. You know what God calls that? Lukewarm. Right? You remember the church at Laodicea back in the book of Revelation? He says you're not hot. You're not cold. You didn't go too far. Right? You're lukewarm. So I'll spew you out of my mouth. Don't go too far. Don't be a fanatic. Don't be an extremist. Don't be a zealot. Right? Don't go too far. And so anyway, that's what Satan, what this world tries to get us to do. We do find that Moses actually agrees to this, though. I think he's caught on by now that Pharaoh's going to renege on it. He's going to go back. He says, okay, Pharaoh, I'll play your game. Sure, I'll get rid of the flies for you. You're not going to let us go anyway. But he actually does say to Pharaoh, he says, don't deal deceitfully with us again. But he knows he's going to. And so Moses prayed, the flies left, and it says there in verse number 31, there remained not one. Could you imagine going from flies everywhere? I mean, every time you yawn, they like fly in your mouth, to where there is not one single fly left in the entire land of Egypt. I mean, just no flies. They become extinct in the land of Egypt. And so that happens the next day, just as he said. And verse 32, Pharaoh hardened his heart at this time also, neither would he let the people go. Not a single fly remained, but Pharaoh still went back on his word, to no surprise to anybody. And so to recap what we've seen so far, the miracle of the rod was reproduced and Pharaoh wouldn't listen. The water turned to blood was unpleasant and inconvenient. There would have been an economic impact. There would have been dead fish and all of this. The frogs, the lice, the flies would have been incredibly annoying. At times it would have been painful. It was definitely a challenge to their gods, but there was no real lasting impact when it was all over. And so that's about to change. The plagues are about to be taken up a couple notches. And before it's over, Egypt is going to be destroyed. It's going to be lying in ruins. There's going to be, honestly, nothing really left in Egypt. It's going to look like a war zone, a disaster area. And even though it's going to be basically in ruins, it's going to be destroyed, they will know the true God by the time the Israelites leave. And so that's what God is setting out to do. And so final lesson for us, just for us as Christians, God wants us to follow him. He wants us to serve him. He doesn't want us to stay in the land. He doesn't want us to go not too far. He wants us to trust him and follow him completely. That is where the path of true blessing is. That's where we are actually living according to what he has made us to be. When we are realizing our true purpose, our true potential is when we're actually following him. And he doesn't want to settle for us doing any less than that. But whenever we are living in sin, whenever we are living in disobedience to him, whenever we are living in this world and for this world, he will begin to deal with us so that we will know that he is greater than all the things that we are making gods. And he is going to work in our lives. He is going to challenge the areas in our lives that we have elevated to godhood. And we think to ourselves, well, we haven't elevated anything to godhood. Anything in our lives that becomes more important than God, God will topple over. You realize that? The things that we have elevated and we have made so important and so special, God is able to topple those. He will send things into our lives that will go right straight for the heart of our gods that we've set up. Why? Because he loves us. Because he wants us to know him. He wants us to be in that relationship, that walk, that trust with him. And it requires that discipline. And so we don't see God as being an enemy. We don't see him as being some kind of a tyrant. We see him as one who is turning us from all of the destructive paths that we are on to that right relationship with him that we are created to be in so that we could actually live the life that he wants us to live. Even though all of these things going on in Egypt were unpleasant, were destructive, God was using this for a purpose for their good. Right? God does the same thing in our lives. Don't let it go to the place where he has to turn your world upside down before you'll finally give in and follow him. He can do it. It doesn't have to be that way. So anyway, any questions, comments?
plague of the lice, Pharaoh doesn't ask, remove the lice. But just go straight into the flies. The next plague.
Right.
So the flies and the lice are there at the same time?
Possibly. I don't know. As it reads, if we're not careful, we're reading this and we're thinking boom, 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 back to back. Like it all happened in a week. I think it happened more over a six-month period. And a couple of reasons for that, because of the time of the flooding of the Nile for the plague of the flies, if we would do that. And then we're going to find whenever the storms, the hail, the lightning and all that, that was the time of the flax and the barley, which would have put that somewhere around February. And then later on, we find that the death of the firstborn happens at the time of the Passover, which would have been around April. And so the hail in, I forget which number it is, it was in February, the death of the firstborn in April. Backtrack a little bit, the flooding of the Nile would have been, I think, autumn, somewhere around there. So we're looking at probably a six-month period of time that this is covering. And so rather than it just being every day, here comes Pharaoh, here comes Moses, they meet together every day, oh, new plague. I think there was some time in between it. I do know that the water into blood was 7 days, but we get the idea that, okay, day eight, we bring the next plague, we bring the frogs out. I don't know if that's necessarily the case. It was the next thing that happened, but it could have been weeks, it could have been a month or so. So that kind of reorients our thought behind this as it's slowly progressing and it's giving a little bit of time. And just a point of significance, it's giving the people of Egypt time to talk to the Hebrews, right? Because none of this is going to be done secretly. And so all the waters turn to blood. They know that it has something to do with the Hebrews. And the Egyptians begin talking to the Hebrews and saying, what's going on here? The Nile is our God. It is the lifeblood. And now your God has made it literal blood. Tell me about your God. Right? And by the time we get up to when the hail comes and all of that, the warning goes out and there's a lot of people who heed the warning. There's a lot of people who believe what Moses is telling them and they bring in their servants, they bring in their livestock, and they don't suffer loss at this time because they actually believed. And so I believe the gap in between this was giving the Egyptians time to hash this out a little bit. Pharaoh may be hardening his heart, but we lose sight of the fact that a lot of the Egyptians were softening theirs. And we find that whenever the children of Israel finally do leave, they leave with a mixed multitude. That means there's a lot of people who are not Hebrews leaves with them. Why do they leave with them? They saw the God of the Hebrews. And they said, he sure beats every god I've ever worshipped. He's already proven himself against anything I've ever worshipped and proved that they're nothing. So I think I'll follow the God of the Hebrews. And they do, and they follow him in the wilderness.
I have a question. In all these places, we're still going to learn them more. Does it, when they happen, impact on Israel people as well?
The first time that it lists anything as far as there being the division is that of the flies. And so for the plague of the blood, it had to affect Israel because the Nile was the lifeblood of the, it was the source of all of it. And so they would have been dependent on it. So that would have affected the Israelites. The frogs, we find no indication that they were severed away. So they had to put up with the frogs, the lice as well. But whenever it came to the frogs, there was a distinction made. And so with the frogs, there's a distinction with the death of the livestock. God says it's not going to affect the livestock of the Jews. And in fact, it actually says that Pharaoh sends his messengers, sends his servants over to Goshen and says, check on the cattle of the Jews and see what's going on over there. His servants go over and looks around and says, not a single death among them. I think it actually extended the life of some of Israel's cows just because they couldn't die during that time. And so anyway, that's my thoughts on it. And so with that, they're rescued from it. With the plague of the hail, I don't really think that the hail fell in the land of Israel. They would also trust God and would bring all their cattle away from the land that would. Something interesting to me is that during the middle of that storm, the plague, the fire on the ground, all of that, Pharaoh sends messengers to Moses, and Moses and Aaron come to Pharaoh. So they have to travel in that storm. And so I almost wonder if it's like the Red Sea, that it's just like parts over them and they just walk through and there's like hailstones on both sides of them and they just got like a path in the middle of it. You know, I wonder if that's what's going on, because he gets there safely. But yeah, it's not until the flies that God actually severs them and the plagues don't affect the Jews.
So that's kind of my question. It only seems on the flies that God separates, not mm-hmm. Israel, to suffer them. Mm-hmm. But again, what could have been the reason Israel people have to suffer the same punishment for Egyptians?
Well, I don't believe the first ones were actually punishments. Mm. Okay? The first ones are more or less to get their attention, and they weren't necessarily harmful, they were annoying. And so God was demonstrating himself to the Jews, because even at that point, a lot of the Jews didn't know him, didn't understand him, didn't realize. And so they were experiencing it as well to get their attention.
Yeah.
But their hearts were softer toward him than the rest of them. And that turning point was there with the flies, which still was not necessarily harmful. Mm-hmm. But then the next step, you're going to lose your livestock. You're going to lose your fields. You're going to lose your homes. You're going to lose all of these other things. Then destruction and punishment starts falling. Death and destruction comes. But the Jews have to go through the annoying times, but they don't have to go through the actual judgments, pain and suffering that the Egyptians do. And like I said, that comes back to, I think God will sever his church from the wrath that's going to come during the tribulation. Because yes, there has been persecution, there has been martyrdom, there has been death, there's been all those things down through the ages, but that hasn't been the judgment of God, that hasn't been the punishment of God. He is going to release that during the 7 years of tribulation, and we're going to be out of there before that happens. Anything else? Okay, well, let's go ahead and we'll go to the Lord in prayer. And next week we're going to, never mind on that one. We're going to go to the Lord in prayer. Lord, we come to you today. Thank you for your blessings. Lord, we thank you for all that you do for us, Lord. We do thank you for these lessons that we have from your word, from this that the Israelites, the Egyptians went through, Lord, and the way that you interacted with them, Lord, and just the overall emphasis, Lord, that you were revealing yourself to them, Lord, drawing them to yourself, Lord. And Lord, I just pray, ask you, help us take these lessons, learn them, apply them to our lives, Lord. And Lord, we just thank you, and we love you, and we praise you for all you do. Blessings, I pray in Jesus' name. Amen.